This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents An Inconvenient Book, Real Solutions to the World's Biggest Problems by Glenn Beck. Read by the author.
Section 1. Global Warming, Storming, and Conforming. The skyline of Miami is a spectacular sight, but not because of the lights, the sunsets, or even the flesh-covered plastic that's wrapped in bikinis lying on the beaches in the distance. It's the cranes. There are dozens of them. It looks as if every two buildings in the city are divided by one that's under construction, topped with a crane like a star on the top of a Christmas tree. It's truly Southern Florida's capitalist equivalent of the birth of Christ. In the next few years alone, approximately 100 skyscrapers will be somewhere between the stages of just finished or about to be started, and that's just in downtown Miami. Drive across to Miami Beach or down to Fort Lauderdale, and you'll see similar, if not quite as dramatic, development. Even 60 miles north of Miami, the far-from-fabulous, overly-underwhelming oceanfront Briny Breezes trailer park has caught the eye of developers. They've offered to buy the land from the 411 Briny Breeze residents for $510 million, a deal that would have made almost all of them instant millionaires. Of course, South Florida is also the haven for the rich and famous. Lenny Kravitz, Ricky Martin, Anna Kournikova, Diddy, or the Didster, as I like to call him, Gloria Estefan, Beyonce, Matt Damon, Calvin Klein, Hulk Hogan, and Rosie O'Donnell are just a few who own houses there. Yes, the overwhelming scientific consensus is people want to live in Miami. The question is, why? Have they not seen an inconvenient truth? Do they not know the risks of global warming? Why are people so passionate about living in a place that will soon be underwater? There seems to be an incredible disconnect between what Al Gore says and what people do. Why is that, do you suppose? Some, of course, will blame a mass disinformation campaign funded by evil big oil that can only be deciphered by the enlightened 21% of Americans who think that greenhouse gases are the most important factor causing global warming. But the truth is that most people never even hear honest questioning on this issue because when it comes to global warming, dissent has its price. Here are a few quick highlights of what the enlightened say about those who dare to ask logical questions about global warming. Heidi Cullen, climatologist at the Weather Channel, suggested disagreement should mean a loss of meteorological certification. Quote, if a meteorologist can't speak to the fundamental science of climate change, then maybe the AMS shouldn't give them the seal of approval. Ellen Goodman from the Boston Globe wrote, quote, let's just say that global warming deniers are now on par with Holocaust deniers. The one denies the past, and the other denies the present and future. David Roberts of climate website, Grist, wrote, when we've finally gotten serious about global warming, when the impacts are really hitting us, and we're in full worldwide scramble to minimize the damage, we should have war crimes trials for these bastards. Some sort of climate Nuremberg. In fact, the Nazi references are quite popular with this crowd. I was even called CNN's chief corporate fascism advocate by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. When asked by the Washington Post why I was a fascist or fascism advocate, Kennedy said he recalled that I was, quote, voicing doubts about global warming a few weeks back. How dare I? But the fact is that RFK Jr. recalled, translation, some blog told him, incorrectly. I simply ask questions about whether or not man is primarily responsible, which, as you'll see, is an entirely reasonable question. Since I know I'm going to be taken out of context and made to say what I don't believe, let me try to make my position perfectly clear. 1. Yes, I think the globe has warmed a bit. Approximately 0.74 degree Celsius, plus or minus 0.18 degree in the last 100 years. 0.74 plus or minus 0.18. Isn't that a 26% margin of error? 2. Yeah, I think man might be responsible for some part of that warming, although I'm not 100% convinced of how much. 126% margin of error. 3. I believe that natural changes are also playing a part in the warming, and that the only thing constant about the climate is change. 4. I believe we don't fully understand the climate yet, and we must be careful until we do. 5. I don't believe the so-called solutions, such as the Kyoto Protocol, are the answer for a myriad of reasons. See point 4. 6. I believe that science, governments, and the media must stop shutting down dissenting views. And 7. Because I live in the Northeast, I kind of like approximately 30 degrees of global warming in the winter, followed by about a 10-degree global cooling in the summer. A gentle global breeze would be kind of nice. Now, I'm not a scientist. I've never sat in a lab with beakers and test tubes and poured bubbling liquids together to make smoky gases, but I am a thinker. I've tried to boil down a ridiculous amount of information into some of the more interesting arguments from actual scientists known as skeptics. Warning, there's a reason scientists don't have girlfriends. Yeah, the stuff can get a little boring at times. I'll do my best to keep it short and as little like physical torture as possible. An Inconvenient Truth pumped more graphs, charts, and animations into the American airwaves in one movie than is normally allowed by the EPA in a century. But one of the more famous visuals was the previously mentioned Drowning Peninsula of Florida, where the ocean rises up to cover Florida as if it were a raft that a really fat person had just stepped on. The water engulfs everything from the southern tip of Florida to about 100 miles north and connects Lake Okeechobee to the Atlantic Ocean. But Gore's apocalyptic, yet tropical, hey, apocatropical, that's pretty good, vision of the future was based on a water level rise that is about 17 times higher than what the United Nations International Panel on Climate Control, or IPCC, is expecting. In fact, it's even 5 times higher than the high end of the worst-case scenario painted by scientists who thought the UN report was too conservative. ADD moment. When I say those who disagree with the consensus on global warming are routinely attacked, I should point out an important caveat. You seem to be criticized only if you say there will be less devastation. When Gore says there will be far more than the UN, he's not only embraced, that guy wins Oscars. Another one of the most powerful moments in An Inconvenient Truth is when Al Gore gets on his fancy hydraulic lift and stands in front of a gigantic screen featuring a graph that shows carbon dioxide, or CO2 as a scientist like to call it, and temperature moving in unison for hundreds of thousands of years. Well, since I had gone to the movie with an open mind, I initially thought to myself, wow, there very well may be something to this. Sure, Al Gore is kind of creepy and a tad robotic, and without a doubt is giving a tabloid version of the facts, but there seems to be a pretty obvious correlation. Not surprisingly, there is a reason the chart was zoomed out so far. It's because perspective is everything. If you zoom in, you'll start to see that in many cases, the temperature rises before CO2 rises, sometimes between 800 and 1,000 years earlier. As geologist and paleoclimate expert Dr. Bob Carter puts it, to say that CO2 is the primary cause of temperature change is like saying that lung cancer causes smoking. Have you ever noticed that from the time you wake up in the morning until the middle of the day, the globe seems to warm? Have you also noticed how that warming seems to correspond with that gigantic ball of fire in the sky? I don't know about you. It's weird, isn't it? Actually, many scientists do believe the activity of the sun is at an 8,000-year high over the past 60 years and may very well be at least partially responsible for the recent warming trend. The correlation between solar activity and temperature is unmistakable, but scientists are still debating how much influence the sun really has. In 2004, Paula Reimer, a paleoclimate expert in Queen's University in Belfast, said, quote, "Whether solar activity is a dominant influence in these climate changes is the subject of intense debate," end quote. But 2 years later, in September 2006, she updated her opinion. Quote, "A couple of years ago, I would not have said that there was any evidence for solar activity driving temperatures on Earth. Now, I think there's fairly convincing evidence," end quote. Environmentalists like to say that the solution to global warming is for every person to do his or her part. The truth is that their ideas on how we should all do that are almost always symbolic gestures and do nothing to actually change CO2 emissions. Honestly, if buying a hybrid would really help, I would gladly do it. What black-hearted nightmare of a human being is going to put the fact that a Honda Insight looks like a retarded spaceship ahead of the future of the entire globe? But what these same environmentalists don't tell you is just how small a piece of the puzzle your choice of automobile really is. So, let me try to put this into perspective for you. Just the increase in the amount of coal that China will burn by 2020 will send as much CO2 in the atmosphere as 3 billion Ford Expeditions, each driven 15,000 miles a year. That's right. The increased burning of one source of energy by one country is equal to the CO2 emissions from 3 billion giant Ford Expedition SUVs. At its current pace, it would take Ford 15,000 years even to sell that many. What about another personal solution constantly presented to us? The compact fluorescent light bulb, the frickin' bane of my existence. Australia has implemented one of the most aggressive campaigns in the world. They expect old-style incandescent light bulbs to be completely phased out by 2010. Great. The Australian government bragged that the program will save an average of 800,000 metric tons of CO2 per year for the next 4 years. Wow! That must make a huge difference, right? Wrong. What they left out is that the savings equate to a paltry 0.21% of Australian emissions. To put it another way, an entire continent being forced to use fluorescent light bulbs will reduce the world emissions by 0.003%. Of course, increases in other sectors would nullify the entire cut in approximately 5 hours. Full disclosure here, it is possible the planned savings could skyrocket to a 0.011% of projected world emissions by 2015. Look, if you want to buy a hybrid or use a fluorescent light bulb, go ahead. Please, don't take this dose of truth as my way of telling you not to do so. But just like it is with the American Idol contestant that has no talent, it's time somebody breaks the news to you. These changes will make essentially no difference in the problems you're trying to solve. Gosh, now I kind of feel like Simon Cowell, minus the English accent and tens of millions of dollars. Call me old-fashioned, but I kind of have a hard time basing my planning for the future of the globe on the same device that brings me to YouTube to watch videos like Boy Falls Off Roof, Lands on Cat. Computer models have drastically improved our understanding of everything, from the climate to how to be a proficient minesweeper, but they're far from infallible. In a 2007 report, what a surprise, largely ignored by the media, David Bromwich, a researcher with the Byrd Polar Research Center at Ohio State University, found that temperatures in Antarctica are not matching up with what climate models have been predicting. Quote, the best we can say right now is the climate models are somewhat inconsistent with the evidence that we have for the last 50 years from continental Antarctica. We're looking for a small signal that represents the impact of human activity, and it's hard to find at the moment, end quote. Remember, computer models are dependent on the humans that design them. Humans who so often already have their minds made up. If these things are wrong, even by a few tenths of a degree per decade, we could easily be facing another global cooling hysteria like in the 1970s. ADD moment here, Your Honor. To truly test computer models, I had my producer, Stu, run an in-depth experiment using quite possibly the most advanced simulation software of all time, a computer program with more than $2 trillion invested in it so far. Yes, Madden 2007. For PlayStation 3, he ran 20 simulations of the 2006-07 NFL season, which, in reality, ended with the Colts defeating the Bears 29-17 in the Super Bowl. But our Madden simulations predicted the Colts getting to Super Bowl only 3 times and the Bears only 2x. It correctly predicted both teams in the game just 1x, which was the same number of times it matched up the Oakland Raiders and the Detroit Lions, the 2 worst teams in the league. Oh well, so much for simulations. As soon as it's released, the main report from the UN IPCC is always immediately embraced by the mainstream media. But the UN released another report on climate change in November 2006 that barely received any coverage at all. It was the same organization talking about the same topic, but this report didn't neatly fit into the media's political agenda, so it was largely ignored. The report stated that livestock and the industry revolving around it are responsible for 18% of all greenhouse gases when measured in CO2 equivalent. That's more than the entire worldwide transportation sector. My first reaction was to support the brutal murder of all cows.
Attention, Hollywood vegans! You're either with us or you're with the bovines!
But I quickly reminded myself about the law of supply and demand. The more juicy porterhouse you eat, the more cows they'll bring into this world to kill our lovely planet. Livestock is responsible for 65% of a less publicized greenhouse gas, nitrous oxide. That warms the planet 296 times more than CO2. In addition, livestock's natural emissions, you know what I'm saying, produce methane, which warms the planet 23 times as much as CO2 and is infinitely more fragrant. Since meat consumption is due to double by 2050, it's only going to get a whole lot worse. In addition, because methane cycles out of the atmosphere in less than 1/12 of the time that CO2 does, avoiding meat is a far quicker and more effective way of cutting greenhouse gases. I know that Al Gore is forced to travel around the globe in private jets to give his fancy slideshows, but he doesn't have to eat meat. Neither do global warming campaigners Bill Clinton, Arnold Schwarzenegger, John McCain. But they all do it anyway. At least we have finally one piece of science that is settled. Any global warming activist that isn't a vegan is a hypocrite. ADD moment. If the coastline floods, will we finally make the lowered, pimped-out Honda Civics a thing of the past? If so, I'm going to Lowe's, buy the longest garden hose I can find, run it from my faucet to the ocean, and leave it on until I stop seeing 1985 Toyota Corollas with ground effects. Yeah, we might lose another 14 The Fast and Furious sequels, but that's just a risk I'm willing to take. One of the more amusing attacks on those who dare to doubt any piece of the wide-ranging global warming consensus is to accuse them of receiving funding from Big Oil or some evil equivalent. If they haven't been paid directly by ExxonMobil, they surely know someone who knows someone whose great aunt teaches at a school where one of her students' brother was given a green Hess truck for Christmas in 1987. And when one of those links just isn't available, the scientist is simply a hack. But that's another story. Honestly, who is a big oil company going to give its money to? The politician it believes is giving it a fair shot? Or the politician who's literally saying its product is killing the earth? In reality, people and companies give their money to politicians and groups who believe what they believe. It's normally not too sinister. But the obvious implication of these attacks is that a scientist or a politician who receives funding from an organization cannot be depended on to fairly analyze information about their cause. With that in mind, here are the top 10 recipients of environmental special interest cash from 2000 to 2004, the campaign years. Do I even need to include their party affiliation? Number 1, 2004, John Kerry. Number 2, Al Gore in 2000. Number 3, Paul Wellstone, 2002. Number 4, Barbara Boxer, 2004. Number 5, Bill Bradley, 2000. Number 6, Mark Udall, 2000. Number 7, Jay Inslee, 2000. Number 8, Gene Shaheen, 2002. Number 9, Gene Carnahan, 2002. Number 10, Barack Obama, 2004. When science, reason, and political attacks alone can't win the battle of ideas, it's time to start thinking like the director of a horror movie. How long till one of those sequels to Saw has some half-dressed 18-year-old girl being tortured by the evils of global warming? Oh, you know it's coming. Here are some of my favorite scare tactics used in the media recently. Boo! Scared you, didn't I? Here's my favorite. Quote, polar bears may turn to cannibalism. ABC News reported this on June 13th, 2006. This one's a little confusing to me. I guess I don't want a bunch of cuddly, white-furred Jeffrey Dahmers lounging around in the Arctic, but what kind of polar bears are we talking about? The cute animated ones from the Coke commercials? Or the real ones that would rip your chest open as if it was plastic wrap on a package of ground beef? If it's those polar bears, I say we let them eat each other. The next warning came from the San Francisco Chronicle on February 13th, 2005. It's much too late to sweat global warming. Okay. So there's nothing anyone can do about it. Why would I do anything about it? How about this one? A hedgehog named Glenn is, quote, having to make do without any prickles, apparently thanks to global warming, end quote, said the UK Daily Mail on January 31st, 2007. This, I think, is a very ineffective scare tactic. People don't like prickles on animals. I'm sure, on the surface, hedgehogs aren't excited about their version of male pattern balding, but maybe if they didn't have their skin covered in needles, they'd make a more snuggly pet. How about this one? Swarms of giant hornets renowned for their vicious stings and skill at massacring honeybees have settled in France. Global warming has largely been blamed. This from the Telegraph in the UK, February 22, 2007. Asian hornets are supposedly living longer because of global warming and are becoming a threat to European beehives? So, hornets are endangering bees? To me, that sounds like the kind of sectarian violence I can get behind. Interestingly, scare tactics seem to lead to bizarre and extreme measures to solve problems. Look how far we've come from the global cooling scare of the 1970s. The solution, then, Newsweek reported on April 28, 1975, quote, climatologists are pessimistic that political leaders will take any positive action to compensate for the climate change, or even to allay its effects. They concede that some of the more spectacular solutions proposed, such as melting the Arctic ice cap by covering it with black soot or diverting Arctic rivers, might create problems far greater than those they solve. End quote. Oof, might? The solution now? How about this one? Quote, a layer of pollution deliberately spewed into the atmosphere to help cool the planet. Balloons bearing heavy guns be used to carry sulfates high aloft and fire them into the stratosphere, end quote, wrote Nobel Prize-winning climatologist Paul J. Crutzen in The Washington Post, November 16, 2006. The reception, on the whole, is a lot more positive than I thought, he said. By the way, an inconvenient footnote. This period of horrific swings and misses called global cooling is usually dismissed by saying that there wasn't as much certainty then as there is now. Really? You'd be hard-pressed to find that sentiment in the Newsweek article itself. In fact, there are grandiose statements in the exact opposite direction. Quote, "The evidence in support of these predictions has now begun to accumulate so massively that meteorologists are hard-pressed to keep up with it," end quote. But the global cooling age was far from the first climate scare. The New York Times wrote scary articles about cooling in 1924, warming in 1935, back to cooling in 1975, and, of course, warming again today. Time did essentially the same thing. Cooling in 24, warming in 39, back to cooling in 74, then warm again today. Some will say, 1975 was a long time ago. Science has improved so much since then. Well, obviously that's true. Scientists have done an immeasurable amount of good, usually as a result of allowing a full, honest, and open debate, the sort of debate not afforded to scientists from Switzerland in 1990. While discussing the Montreal Treaty, which was designed to close the hole in the ozone layer, Swiss scientists said that changing to the chemicals being discussed would make another problem much worse: global warming. In fact, the new chemicals that scientists and environmentalists approved without listening to Switzerland's objections can harm the environment up to 10,000 times more than carbon dioxide emissions. So the lesson here is simple. Question everything. You know, unless the Swiss say it. Remember, environmentalists believed another ice age was right around the corner because temperatures had trended down from about 1940 through 1975. At the exact same time, CO2 emissions were skyrocketing. Put it another way, as CO2 emissions went up, temperatures went down. But that fact, much like the musical career of Leif Garrett, never gets acknowledged today. That's not to say those 30 years make a global climate trend, but maybe, just maybe, the last 30 years don't either. To fight this pathetic record of ineptitude, the media, along with some members of the scientific community, just turn up the heat. They say they are more sure, and they make more colorful statements about their certainty, and they get more violent with their language to those who dare question them. Early in 2007, the Houston Chronicle ran a story with the headline, "Scientists Fear They've Oversold Global Warming." Well, wait a minute. If that's true, then it didn't take long for the scientific community to continue to get over their fear. The very next day, Andrew Weaver, a co-author of the UN climate report, said, quote, "His findings aren't a smoking gun, but a barrage of smoking intergalactic missiles." Who even talks like that? Oh, by the way, ADD moment. It only took a week before an article appeared referring to the Barrage of Intergalactic Missiles report and going even farther. It was entitled, "Experts, Latest Climate Report, Too Rosy." If science has occasional problems, the media have more, and the government has an unlimited supply. So far, the major solution that we've been pitched to fix global warming is the Kyoto Protocol, an embarrassment even by government standards. To oversimplify the concept, Kyoto is basically a worldwide treaty created in the late 1990s that sets caps on each country's carbon dioxide emissions. Even if we pretend for a second that every single thing global warming alarmists claim is true, which it's not, and the Kyoto Protocol's guidelines were fully implemented, they're not even close, the effect on the climate would still be immeasurably small. But let's take a closer look anyway. You know, since Kyoto is the poster child for climate change proposals. It's been reported that 13 of the original 15 EU nations will miss their targets, along with Canada and Japan. Wait a minute, isn't Kyoto a city in Japan? Russia will hit them, but only because they have to decrease their emissions from the days of the Soviet Empire, meaning they essentially didn't have to do jack. England has a similar story. The British deregulated their electricity industry and eliminated coal subsidies, thereby making natural gas competitive in price for the very first time. People started using more of it, and since it burns cleaner, England's emissions went down, even without a hint of personal virtue involved. The rest of the EU is comical. 64% of EU25 countries increased their greenhouse gas output between 2003 and 2004, the last year the data was available. The emissions of the EU15 have risen since 1999. The EU is only slightly more than one-tenth of the way to its Kyoto goals. Yay! In fact, when Kyoto was opened for signature, the EU had already instantly achieved half its goal, primarily because of economic changes along with the convenient backdating program. See, even though it was 1997, they used 1990 as the benchmark from which countries had to reduce emissions. Since 1997, they have made essentially no progress whatsoever, and unless additional measures are enacted and actually followed, post-Kyoto emissions will actually increase. Then you have China. The Chinese are building one or two new coal plants every week and are now the world's largest emitter of CO2, yet they're completely exempt from Kyoto. Developing nations argue that we should be held to a higher standard. After all, we were free to develop economically without any of these kinds of restrictions. They should be able to do the same. In other words, we did the damage. We should pay the price. Really? Well, how did you get this technology in the first place? How is it cheap and efficient enough for you to afford? What's that? It's because countries like the United States dumped our money into developing it? Oh, yeah, that's right, that's right. I almost forgot. We actually spent our time and energy innovating instead of shutting down newspapers and running over protesters with tanks. This argument shows just how ridiculous the implementation of this sort of agreement is. Everybody always thinks they're getting screwed. When it comes down to it, do you think China is actually going to spend billions of dollars conserving energy in hopes of offsetting environmental problems, many outside their borders, that may occur decades in the future? Or do you think they're going to spend it on something that will immediately affect their economy? Yeah, I know. Trick question. The correct answer is they'll spend it on executing dissidents and buying big missiles to point at us. Here's a surprisingly convenient truth. We've talked a lot about problems, but what about the solutions? Well, where do real solutions to the world's problems come from? The medical answers, the innovations that feed, the technology that moves us forward. Well, I'll tell you where they don't come from. The Congo, Iran, there's also Darfur. They don't come from countries with weak economies wrapped up in war, run by dictators who control the economic development. No, they come from countries like ours. So the best solution to fight global warming is to keep our economy strong, not distracted by attacks on our homeland and without government intrusion. If we're bankrupt, we're not really going to do a thing about global warming. You know what? Let's take a look at hurricanes for a moment. What do we really know about them? One thing we do know is that with or without man-made CO2 emissions, hurricanes will occur, and some of them will be devastating. People who give slideshows for a living promote the idea that continuing to drive your SUV will either result in more of these storms or make them more powerful. Unfortunately, this theory has become so widespread that it's now part of the so-called consensus that thou shalt not question. But uncertainty aside, the science itself is, in many ways, irrelevant as to what we should do about it. Hurricane Katrina was tied directly to global warming in An Inconvenient Truth. Although Al Gore was very subtle about it, the movie's promotional photo featured a hurricane emanating out of a smokestack. Katrina was obviously one of the largest natural disasters this nation has ever faced, but neither the power of the storm nor global warming was to blame. No, the real reason Katrina was so disastrous lies in the fact that it hit a city designed by morons. New Orleans is built in a bowl. Hello! About a year before Katrina hit, I did a radio show about the tragedy that could occur in New Orleans if a powerful storm struck and the levees were breached. I'm not really clairvoyant. The information had been available for decades. The combination of the lack of preventive action, people deciding not to leave, and various government entities alternating between breaking, and perhaps worse, making promises, was what turned Katrina from a hurricane into an event that is worthy of an episode of mega disasters. Immediately following Katrina, another storm also reached Category 5 status, Hurricane Rita. It too made landfall, but only directly killed 7 people. This is far more typical of a powerful hurricane striking America. Global warming did not destroy New Orleans. Geography, stupidity, and long-term government incompetence did. Over and over again, America has weathered natural disasters as no other country has ever done, because we have better buildings, better detection technology, better communication systems to spread the word, and better response teams, despite popular misconception, than anyone else in the world. Why? Money. In 1998, Hurricane Mitch slammed into Honduras, killing about 7,000 people and another 4,000 in Nicaragua. It would later go on to kill 2 people in the United States. In 2004, Hurricane Jean killed more than 3,000 people in Haiti, then 5 people in the United States. True, these storms hit America with less force, but with the noted and explainable exception of Katrina, no hurricane of any strength has hit the United States and killed more than 100 people since 1972. When you hear alarmists ranting about the imminent demise of the universe, you almost always hear them predict a lot about what the future will look like. But to most of us, the future isn't quite as dramatic or frightening as something happening right now. A small meteor may slam into Canada next week, and it's far more interesting than a huge asteroid that might wipe out the entire planet 290 years from now. So, to add the appropriate amount of urgency and drama, environmentalists must say that weather events such as droughts, floods, hurricanes, and extreme temperatures are getting worse and worse right now. And if that's true, then there should literally be no argument about how to move forward. The key to protecting us from the sometimes temperamental Mother Nature is not trying to control the weather. It's improving our society and simply preparing for the inevitable changes. As our technology has improved and nations have become wealthier, the number of people killed as a result of extreme weather worldwide has decreased from 485,200 per year in the 1920s to 19,400 per year from 2000 to 2004. That's a decrease of 96%. And remember, there are a lot more people on the planet right now. So if you look at the death rates per million, you'll see a decrease of an astounding 98.7%. All this while CO2 emissions and temperatures have gone through the roof, and the extreme weather has supposedly worsened. The tangible and measurable results are quite obvious to anybody who can turn on a computer, let alone, you know, produce your own PowerPoint presentation. We are closer to completely eliminating death caused by weather than we are to destroying the planet because of it. Now, armed with this kind of information, what's the better course of action? Should we accept a worldwide mandate that will hurt our economy and must be followed by governments that can't even agree if the Holocaust happened, all in an effort to possibly reduce hurricane intensity by an estimated 0.3% per year? Or should we keep our economy strong, continue to innovate, and then share those inevitable technological and economical innovations with the world? Implementing the emissions caps necessary, theoretically, to lower the temperature 2 degrees Celsius, which is the low end of the UN IPCC projections, would cost the world between $2.4 trillion and $26.5 trillion. Gee, what could we do with that $26.5 trillion instead? No, just the usual boring stuff, like completely eliminating poverty, educating every child on the planet, and providing access to water and sanitation to every soul on Earth for a century. And after that, we'd still have $21.9 trillion left to figure out how to spend. It's not just us evil rich countries affected by this environmental alarmism. Eritrea, little country I'd never heard of, it's located right next to beautiful Ethiopia, has announced plans to make its entire coastline an environmentally protected zone. It would specifically protect coral reefs, mangrove forests, and I kid you not, nesting sites for turtles, and 73 species of seabirds. That's their priority? This is a country with a life expectancy of less than 60, a literacy rate of 58.6%, and a poverty rate of around 50%, and they're worried about a little turtle sex? I believe it was environmental scholar Richard Cheney who said it best. Conservation may be a sign of personal virtue, but it's not a sufficient basis for a sound, comprehensive energy policy. He was, of course, beaten up by every .org in America for saying that, but it's true. The answer isn't for everybody to make sure their lights are turned off when they leave their room. It's not spending trillions on limiting an unmanageable system. And it's not making sure turtles have privacy, you know, when they do it. So here's my solution. Let me propose a radical course of action to solve global warming. Inaction. I'm so sick of hearing, "But shouldn't we at least try?" No. We shouldn't just try. We should try smart. When government just tries, it creates a new set of problems without solving the old ones. Imagine if they had just tried to solve global cooling. We'd have far bigger problems on our hands today. The only true answer to this situation is to innovate and adapt. The innovation part of the equation is both ongoing and virtually unstoppable. Investment in alternative energy reached an estimated $63 billion in 2006, more than double that of just 2 years earlier. Almost 10% of all venture capital funding in America goes to clean energy. And this investment has already paid dividends. The cost of generating power from wind has dropped by 60% since 1990. The power from the first solar cells and satellites is now 98.7% cheaper than when it was introduced. These technologies will be adopted by the world when, and only when, they make economic sense, not when we have to depend on countries like Russia or China to be virtuous. Sure, our government can help in the form of tax breaks and incentives, but capitalism is already on its way to solving the problem itself. And at the same time, we need to adapt with more obvious solutions. When the heat wave of 2003 hit Europe, nearly 35,000 mostly elderly people died. The size and the scope of this tragedy gave the global warming theorists an opportunity to spout their views to almost every news camera on the globe. They claimed that events like this justify the EU spending an estimated $1.443 trillion by 2023 to alter its energy industry enough to possibly avert climate change. Let me be crazy and propose another option here. 100 years ago, there was nothing you could do about a heat wave except stay away from fat, smelly, sweaty relatives. Now, we can do this little magic thing called condition the air. 35,000 air conditioners will cost about $2.5 million. Or perhaps you pick a few vacant office buildings that your economy and its double-digit unemployment rates can't support and turn the AC on. Then just fire up a few gasoline-powered school buses and shuttle old people to the air-conditioned facilities. Repeat every time it gets hot. In spite of what we want to believe, the Earth is not a Lexus that we can climb into, turn the climate control to a comfortable 70 degrees, and leave it there until the end of time. The real climate has millions of variables, and there is still way too much that we don't know. So until we understand all of it, the best way we can help is by continuing to increase our investment in clean energy. It's good for our country and the world for other reasons. And if global warming is as awful as some believe, clean energy will help solve that too. If you disagree, consider the historical equivalent of what's happening right now. Today's politicians are trying to fix what they believe will be the main environmental issue in the year 2100. Back in 1900, the environmentalists of the day were wrestling with the disposal of manure left in the streets from all of the horses carting people around our cities. How do you think the Congress of the early 1900s would have done figuring out how to solve the major environmental and scientific issues of today? Section 2. Marriage, porn, adultery, and divorce. The circle of life. When it comes to love, mine is an age-old story. Boy meets girl. Boy falls in love with girl. Boy becomes big-time top 40 DJ. Boy marries girl. Boy meets Jack Daniels. Boy falls in love with Jack Daniels. Jack Daniels comes between boy and girl. Girl divorces boy. Boy becomes slave to Jack Daniels. Boy gets fat and grows long hair to appear young and less fat. Boy fools no one. Boy hits rock bottom. Fall broken by fatness and ridiculous hair. Boy breaks up with Jack Daniels. Boy begins to straighten out. Boy gets haircut and loses weight. Kind of. Boy meets new girl. Boy falls in love with new girl. Girl falls in love with boy. Boy amazed. Boy marries new girl. Boy trades top 40 for talk radio. Boy does hilarious impression of new girl's voice to the delight of millions.
I don't think it's funny.
Boy and girl live happily ever after. I know. You've heard it a million times before. But that doesn't mean I don't have a unique perspective on affairs of the heart. See, I've had my fair share of experience with women. Oh, yeah. And not just with the likes of Sarah Lee, Little Debbie, and Dolly Madison. Although I've made sweet, tender love in my kitchen in my underpants at night to all three of the ladies. I've made every mistake a guy can make. I've been married, I've screwed up, and I've been unmarried, as I like to call it. In fact, I've made my way around the entire circle of life. Marriage, porn, adultery, divorce. I may not know where every detour, speed bump, or radar trap is along the way, but I hope I can make your trip just a little easier. Bing! Thanks for flying, Glen Airlines. By describing the ones I do know about. Buckle up. It's gonna get bumpy. Oh, and by the way, kids, if you're listening, oh, this will scar you for life. Skip to the next chapter. Marriage. Finding love is hard. Staying in love is even harder. Unless you're Bill or Hillary Clinton, and obviously incapable of loving anything except the sound of your own voice and your misguided views about, well, just about everything. If you do manage to navigate the treacherous waters of dating, which I won't go into here since I've already devoted an important section to it, and you find yourself actually married to someone, congratulations! I mean, the amount of deception that goes into duping another person into spending their entire life and eternity with you is astounding. And you, my friend, should be proud of your accomplishment. I found this pride can actually help take the sting out of the fact that you had to buy her a ring that cost more than a fleet of plasma TVs. It is certainly the way I feel about my marriage to Tanya. It's almost as if I used false advertising to lure her into a purchase, and now she's lost the receipt, so she's stuck. Sucker! But I couldn't be happier about it. I honestly believe with all my heart I wouldn't be alive today if not for her. She's lent stability and strength to my life that are impossible to overstate. Although I don't think she really even cares about what I do, I bet you she hasn't even noticed that this book is dedicated to her. Really. I don't like doing things without her. We're not codependent. We're in love. I am truly less than half the man when I'm not with her. Tanya and I are truly a partnership. Our marriage works because we work at it together. But you know what? That simple concept wasn't always clear to me. I used to believe that marriage was the end of the circle, that the work of a relationship ends once you exchange your vows. It'd be a lot easier if that were true. But in reality, it's just the beginning. That's probably one big reason why my first marriage didn't really make it. Well, that and...
Hello? My name is Glenn?
To truly understand how great my second marriage is, you have to understand how badly I screwed up my first. In case there's, you know, anybody left on planet Earth who doesn't know, I'm a recovering alcoholic. And let me get you caught up quickly. I used to drink. A lot. There's a good chance that I single-handedly put the children of Brown Foreman shareholders, proud makers of Jack Daniel's Tennessee whiskey, all through college during the late 80s and early 90s. But even if you haven't yet traveled the full circle, you probably have enough sense to realize that a long-term relationship with a bottomless tumbler of Jack with a twist of Coke isn't really the recipe for a successful marriage. But I didn't really realize that, and my first marriage fell apart. I was a bad husband and a worse father, I think, for longer than I care to think about. But here's the key. I do think about it every day. That's the best way I know to make sure I never really fall into the same traps again. Looking back, I realize that I was young, foolish, weak. There were issues from my family's past that I should have dealt with even before I thought of starting my own family, but it's just not the way it played out. Fortunately, even though my first marriage had an ending, it was a relatively happy one. My ex and I have made our peace, and... for my sake, I'm glad she didn't make her peace with a shovel. And I have a tremendously close relationship with my two daughters from that marriage. I ended up, honestly, with better than I deserve. And I know it. I tell you all of this, time and time again, because it's that experience that helped me to have a second marriage that is nothing less than a gift from God. So, if I may be so bold when it comes to having a successful marriage, here's my solution. You need help. Tanya and I met at two radio promotion events before we ever dated or really even talked. I was in top 40 back then, and if you think I'm annoying now, you should have heard me trying to do funny jokes about Huey Lewis in the news. Good morning this morning. Wah, wah. I was suffering from one of my occasional bouts of sobriety, and I was struggling. One day I told God that I couldn't handle it anymore. If he wanted me to stay sober, it's up to you, God. You better throw a roadblock up in my path. Or else, that Thursday, I was going to have the happiest of hours courtesy of Dr. Jack Daniels.
Paging Dr. Daniels, Dr. Jack Daniels.
God, pretty much kept to himself the whole week. And when Thursday came, I kept my promise because I'm a man of my word. And I headed over to my version of the Regal Beagle. I walked up to the bar and ordered a Jack and Coke. I picked it up from the bar, turned around to take that first glorious sip, and just as I raised the glass to my mouth, the most amazing thing happened.